Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Gia Kim, appearing on behalf of Appellant Manuel Juarez. The central question in this case is, when does tolling start when someone becomes a fugitive from their term of supervised release? And in this case, it's both a legal and factual question. The legal question, which was left open by Murguia Oliveros and answered in a couple different ways in this Court's decision in De La Mora, is whether tolling begins when the violation occurs, or any violation occurs, when a revocation petition is filed on the basis of a violation, or when the bench warrant is issued after that petition is filed. As a question of law, we would submit that tolling begins when the bench warrant is issued on the basis of a violation, not when a defendant simply starts violating any condition of supervised release, or at a minimum, that tolling should start when the defendant violates a condition of supervised release, which then ripens into a petition for revocation and a bench warrant. And as question of fact, in this case, we would argue that the district court erred in finding that Mr. Juarez had failed to report a change of residence back in August 1993 when he applied for a false driver's license under a false name. Turning to the question of law first, tolling for fugitive status should have started.
Let me ask you a question. Are you really suggesting then that it's the actions of the probation office which would determine when the tolling begins rather than the actions of the defendant?
I think the actions of the probation officer are important for this reason.
You didn't answer my question. Are you really suggesting that the actions of the probation office determines when the tolling begins rather than the actions of the defendant?
Yes, Your Honor, and for this reason.
Square that then with De La Mora, where they say right there, it's told from the time the defendant absconds. The defendant's term of supervised release is told from the time he absconds from the supervision until the time he's found. Had nothing to do with the federal authorities having to issue the warrant.
Well, in De La Mora, this court actually cited two dates for when tolling might start. The first, at page 980, stated that the start of his flight corresponded with the February 23, 1998 bench warrant, which was actually several months after he had been in violation of the condition. And then later at page 981, the court writes, in this case, De La Mora's status as an absconder happens to coincide with the date of the unsworn petition, which was also several months after the violation in question occurred. The court never cited the date of the violation, which I believe was in November and December of the previous year, and instead it used the dates of the petition, or the warrant, both of which were in February of the following year and were 3 days apart. Now, in De La Mora...
Is there anything in De La Mora that says the time starts from the time he's found?
At the time he's found by federal authorities?
Right.
I believe generally that would be the time when the tolling
would... Is there anything in De La Mora that suggests that?
I don't believe so. I believe generally that's the time when the tolling would end because he's no longer on fugitive status because the defendant would have been found at that point. But I think De La Mora, there is language in De La Mora saying that it is, you know, the failure to comply with the conditions that makes you a fugitive, but there's also countervailing language that says the date you look at is the date of either the unsworn petition or the date of the bench warrant. Now, in De La Mora, I think if you do the math, it didn't matter which date you used, if you used the date of the violation or the date of the petition or the date of the warrant. In this case, it would matter which of those dates you picked. Either of the two later dates, I believe there wouldn't be sufficient tolling for the district court to have retained jurisdiction, but with the first date, there would have been. And I think the reason that we can look to what the probation office does is that, you know, a defendant on supervised release is subject to many, many conditions. Mr. Juarez, if you look at his judgment and commitment order, had about 20 of them. Included in those were about 14 standard conditions, including such things as don't drink alcohol, work in a lawful occupation. A defendant can often be in violation, technical violation of one of those conditions by, for instance, testing dirty on an alcohol test, or, you know, if Mr. Varez had tried, you know, failed to get a job, he would be in violation of standard condition number 5. I think it's important that probation has made the determination that a certain violation is significant enough to seek a bench warrant in that case, because, you know, if, to take the employment example as one, if the probation officer says, I'm not going to violate you for that formally as long as you do 3 interviews a week, the probation in that case has made a determination not to file a revocation petition.
On the other hand, I take the point, because with all respect, I think Maria Olivares is a little broad, saying any violation makes you an absconder. Not quite sure why that would be the case, because if you start tolling, it's kind of the first violation there. Told, you know, forever, I guess. But in any event, let's suppose it's one where you're removed from supervision or you've committed a serious one like a drug offense. In this case, if the person fails to report a change of address, so they really aren't under supervision anymore physically because they've, you know, changed and gone away, and the probation office doesn't know about it. So meanwhile, then what are they supposed to do? They can't issue a bench warrant until they go find and do some investigation or file a petition and find out he's absconded. So it's,
I see your point, but also under the facts of this case, if you look at the letter supporting the 1995 petition, which was timely, it was filed, they did find out he had returned before the term had expired, but that petition was unsworn, so 10 years later it turned out it wasn't any good under this court's decision in Vargas Amaya. You know, the probation did cites in that letter at ER 44 that he had been found with this false ID and this false name. That's not one of the allegations they actually chose to bring in the petition. There are several other ones at that point, such as illegal reentry or use of drugs, that, you know, date from a later time. So again, probation was aware, it appears from that letter, that he at some point had gotten, that they had received a report, you know, from the state authorities that he had been using this false ID, but that isn't what they chose to allege here. So I think I see your point generally, but in this case there was time, and there was in fact a timely petition filed. It just happened to be unsworn and therefore, you know, not good in that sense.
But that wasn't good enough. Would that have triggered, under your view, that would have triggered the absconding then?
If they had alleged it in the petition, I believe it would have.
Because they didn't allege the failure to report, or, you know.
Exactly, and that was the precise basis at ER 23 in which the district court in this case told the period, the term of supervised release. He could have chosen, you know, there were several other violations to choose from, but he chose to extend the term based on an allegation that was never raised by probation itself.
You have about a minute left.
Okay, and just quickly on the factual question, the district court found that that false ID, that false driver's license that Mr. Juarez obtained, also signaled an intent to notify the state or of a change of residence. And we would just argue with that as a factual matter, because there's nothing else in the record indicating that Mr. Juarez had any ties to that address. And the only evidence in the record, which probation itself cites, was that he was using that false ID, you know, to enter the United States.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, I'm Michael Ruffell on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, the defendant received a 3-year term of supervised release, and he was not serving it during the time after he came back to the country due to his own wrongful act of not providing the probation officer with his whereabouts or his residence. The opposing counsel has analyzed this in terms of a legal question and in terms of a factual question. In terms of the legal question, I think that Murguia and De La Mora are clear enough in their holdings that what determines the time where tolling starts is when the defendant effectively absconds from the terms of his supervision. That's the language used in Murguia. It may be, and in many cases it is, as De La Mora recognized, that that time is the date in which a warrant is issued. For example, if a defendant is on supervised release, being supervised by a probation officer, and simply fails to report once, we don't think that means that suddenly he's off of supervised release and tolling starts. I think it would be reasonable to conclude that tolling would start if the probation officer in that circumstance issues a warrant and says, we can't find him. We're looking for him, we can't find him. In that sort of circumstance, one would look to the warrant. In the circumstance of Murguia and De La Mora, the court looked to the warrant because there's nothing else to look at as far as what date the tolling would start when he effectively absconded. So the legal question, I think, is clear in that framework. The factual question, then, is whether the court clearly erred in finding that this defendant's absconding started on the date that he applied for a California driver's license, August 31st, 1993, essentially stating, my residence is in Riverside, California. And that, we submit, is good enough as a factual matter, certainly with deference to the district court who has to make that determination, and certainly with the additional proof that the defendant actually ended up here in the United States, committing a bank robbery in April 1994, committing a very serious violent robbery in April 1995. With all that added up, there's certainly enough for the district court to determine that this is the date, factually, when the defendant's absconding.
In light of that, I do not understand your letter of February 3rd. Are you suggesting that when the defendant self-removes him from supervised release by unilaterally violating the terms of supervised release to constitute an absconding, absconded, that then puts him in a free zone when he's not subject to the conditions of release? You're saying that the the 94 robbery, the 94 arrest, and the 95 robbery, even though they're plain violations of the conditions of supervised release, are not a violation that would warrant revocation of supervised release?
Yes, Your Honor, I am saying that.
How can you possibly mean that?
Could I explain?
I've had this discussion before in chambers, and when I got your letter, I was astonished.
Well, and this is a concession that, the court may feel.
Does the person behind you arguing today?
I'm the chief of appeals of our office.
What about the who has the next case, who's got the same? Are they on the same page as you on this interpretation of what tolling
means? You mean the next case in our office? In numerous cases in our office, I have advised and we've withdrawn violations. Let me explain, Your Honor, that. Okay. Let's assume the defendant is in prison for 10 years in a state imprisonment. And just hypothetically, every single year he commits an offense such
he's
as...
in prison. Let's take it when he's not in prison. He absconds.
Okay.
He moves, but take this hypothetical.
Yes.
All right. He absconds by leaving in violation of his supervised release. He moves from L.A., to Northern California, and while in Northern California commits a string of robberies. Under your interpretation, he is not in violation of his supervised release because he has, by his own unilateral action, absconded.
Yes.
Therefore, you can't violate him for any of those robberies, that crime spree, drug use, anything, until he's back under the jurisdiction.
Your Honor, we can violate him for absconding,
yes.
And then we can bring in as conduct the court can consider what he did while absconding. And the hypothetical I was trying to say, assume the defendant has fled for 10 years, hypothetically commits a crime every year. can we bring 10 different violations charging, you know, over 10 years, 10 different crimes when he was only on supervised release for a particular time. Our view analytically is simply that we can't sort of have our cake and eat it too, both say he's not on supervised release and then say he is on supervised release and...
He's on supervised release. He has unilaterally extended the time of supervised release.
Well, I would be happy if the court, you know, disagrees with me. We'll certainly follow that. The probation office, of course, is an independent body. It's not like a federal agency. It's part of the court. And it's a little different a circumstance here. So even if we concede something and the probation office and the court disagrees,
trying to understand the rationale.
You might go back and have a little discussion with probation about this.
Sure, we will. This is not squarely brought up in the case.
Right.
I wanted to inform the court of our
position. I appreciate you doing it. I was just astonished.
Nothing in this case turns on it.
Nothing in this case turns on it, and there may be differences we'd be happy to bring those. Substantively, the person deserves to be punished for those, but our view had been that if the term is told and not running, whether because he's in prison, which is statutory tolling, or whether it's tolling because of absconding, either way, if the term's not running, then the person can't be violated for things that he does during that period of time where the term is not running. But that's not squarely raised in this case, and you know the issue here we think is clear.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Just one quick point. I would disagree with the government's contention that you can use the warrant date in certain cases for certain violations and not in others. In both De La Mora and Murguia, this court knew what the dates of the actual violations were. In both cases, they were about 3 or 4 months earlier. Again, in Murguia, it was sort of left open as to which date would be used. But in De La Mora, it had the choice of the dates, and it did use either the petition or the warrant date.
Thank you. The matter just argued is submitted for decision.